Okay. Any questions from your discussions at lunch? Any questions? What were we discussing over here, and then we said we'd go further. Where was it? What was that? Here, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where's the mic?
We continued the discussion,
yes,
on a different kind of level. We,
yes,
we looked at karma, you know, in terms of national and international events we are facing, yeah, at the moment, and how that might work. And we got a bit kind of lost, I think, at some point, uh-huh, in discussion. But like Fukushima or the kind of Philippine events, how does that fit in with individual karma? And,
how does what fit in?
With individual karma.
What was the first part of the sentence?
With individual karma, how does it fit in with individual karma? The you know, the event of being part of a natural disaster of sorts.
Oh, I see. Okay,
actually.
Okay. So the big picture here, which is all part of the understanding of where these practices, you know, of seeing yourself as the Buddha as a technique for coming to the Buddha, fit in, is this fundamental view of Buddha, which we began discussing here, which is what you learn about in the very first level of practice, is this fundamental view of the Buddhas, you know, not just some secondary kind of interesting idea, but it's fundamental to his vision, to his view of the universe, his observation of how things exist, which is why he would say there's no such thing as a creator, why he would say we're not product of the parents, is this view that there are trillions of minds, they're all beginningless continuities of mental moments, they're beginningless necessarily, you know, which we have to get our head around, logically, for the Buddha, being the product of cause and effect, and that, that every microsecond of what any of those minds is doing from moment to moment is producing itself. It's the simplest way to put it. Each of us is producing ourself moment by moment. And so this also then, we can extrapolate from this that we can then, when we die, our mind continues, and then it determines the type of rebirth we have. So like I mentioned briefly, you know, just here, there are four ways that we can say that our past intentional actions, which is the one way of translating the word karma, starting with the word intention, because intention is a function of the mind, and intention is a better translation for the word karma. Every microsecond of what every mind does, and then followed through with the body and speech, this leaves imprints, this programs every mind. Everything anyone does, says and thinks programs that mind. Nothing goes astray, in other words. It produces us from moment to moment, and then indeed as we die, it programs the mind, then it determines the type of rebirth it has. So there's four ways our karma ripens. One is the type of rebirth, human, animal, etc. There's different types of mental existences that come along with the type of physicality. That's all mind possesses. The second way, as we just already mentioned, that our karma ripens, as they say, is in terms of our tendencies, habits that we bring with us, whether it's to play football or music or to be a psycho or to, you know, be loving or compassionate. The third is the type of experiences we have at the hands of others. And let's face it, look at our universe, animals and humans, we're all deeply social beings, aren't we? We all create masses of history with each other. This is the main cause of our bumping into each other again and again, and we do to each other what we've done to each other before. You know, there's no accident, it's not random. It's not random. The parents you get is not random. The people you meet, the rapist you meet, that's your rapist baby. That person who gives you £1 million, that's your £1 million, honey. We created these causes. You know, all this is part of Buddha's view of karma. It's all extensively covered in all the literature, you know. And then the fourth way our karma ripens is called, even it's called environmental karma, the very way the physical world, which let's face it, if we think about it, is made up of the four elements. The very way the physical world impacts upon us. The main cause of all this, the type of rebirth, your tendencies, your experiences, even the physical, even the external environment, the way you experience it. The main causes of all this, the mental and verbal and physical actions of every single sentient being. So it's like we're all running around creating our own realities, moment by moment by moment by moment, you know. So, what was that first part of your question? The first part of the sentence, what was it? The relationship between individual karma and what?
And
Collective. Oh, okay, sure. So yeah, we all have, we all, look at us in this life. We have, we relate to human beings, we relate to people. We have people and animals in our lives, would you agree? Well, they're all sentient beings. Huh? Don't we have? Everybody, to some degree or another, you know? So we either hate each other, love each other, kind to each other, mean to each other. Would you agree? Well, we keep on doing the same thing, you know? This, we keep bumping into the same beings. We do to each other what we've done to each other in the past, simply speaking. It's highly complex how it all actually works, but simply speaking. So in that sense, you could say there's no random event. It can't be. Buddha says karma is a natural law, you know? We either have the view that God made the universe and he's the boss and it's sort of his job, so get your nose out of God's job, let him do his job, and you accept what God does, really. That's the best way to say being a Christian or a Muslim, isn't it? If you're really the best Muslim or Christian, it's all God's will. It's the perfect way, you know. Accept what God does. It's his trip. Or there's the materialist view and we haven't got a clue. We're still trying to find out what the hell's going on, you know. We can't put two and two together. We never know why there's suffering, why there's happiness, why Hitler, why anything. It's all a big puzzle. We don't know yet, we say. We're looking into it, you know. Well, Buddha's got a third option. And often to people in the world, Buddha's view is pretty invisible, because in most traditions even, there's no deep study of Buddha's view. Many people who think they're Buddhist, there's like, you know, do mindfulness meditation or, you know, this kind of thing. It's okay, you can do what you like. But in the Tibetan monastic university system, coming from the great Indian monastic university system, right, you know, there's this tradition of studying all the Buddha's teachings in depth and all the commentaries and of all the great masters over the centuries, you know. So it's, karma is not just some interesting secondary thing. You either like it or don't. Karma is actually Buddha's explanation of the universe. It's his explanation. Of course, it takes time to put all the pieces together, even intellectually, you know, to get to understand it. But for Buddhists, it's fundamental, fundamental. Basically, we create ourselves. So there's nothing random in the people we meet. So we're all groups, aren't we? Males are part of a group, females are part of a group, homosexual people, black people, white people, Australians, English, Scottish, you know? We've all got our groups, animals, we've all got our groups, and we all have enemies and friends and strangers, isn't it? And we all run around, you know, interacting. And we meet the beings we've harmed before and they harm us back, and we meet the ones we've been kind to before and they're kind to us back, and so we keep going. And so, in that sense, there's an intimate relationship between groups and individuals, because groups are made up of individuals, aren't they? Yeah. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Just generally speaking, that's the Buddha's view.
And the environmental angle in this?
Pardon? The what?
The environmental angle on it? I mean,
environmental meaning, okay. One way of saying, and this is coming now from the more esoteric teachings, which are taught in Buddhist Tantra, and this is the model. According to this model, the way the universe is, there's minds and there's matter. The universe consists of minds, trillions and trillions of minds. As I mentioned before, Buddha says there's not an atom of space you won't find minds, mind streams, sentient beings, trillions. And then the physical world, this is called taught in Tantra in great detail, is made up of the four elements. Well, this is the same as Galileo and our mob back in the Middle Ages, you know. They talked about the four elements, earth, air, fire, water. Physical universe is made of the four elements. That's it. So, you know, and then it also the model in Tantra is very, very fascinating discussions. And this is the same model that Tibetan medical system uses, that every mind has this inextricable relationship with its own set of the four elements. So they talk in Tantra, we've got gross consciousness, subtle consciousness, very subtle consciousness. So the process of death, and there's great the detailed descriptions of this, and this is part of the practice, and we get into more advanced practices of doing these Buddhic practices, we learn to replicate the death process for very good reasons. Because in the long term, what you're trying to do as a Buddhist is access a more subtle level of your own mind, because at that level, where it's least encumbered by all the junk, all the delusions, all the neuroses, that level, that subtler level of mind has the power to cut through all the nonsense and realize emptiness and become a Buddha. So the greatest yogis, there's a book I'm working on at the moment of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's, How to Help People at the Time of Death. And as he says, death is what the yogis have been waiting for, not because they're sort of depressed, but because that's when the mind gets to the subtler level. In their meditations throughout their lives, doing these deity practices, and this highly sophisticated kind of technology, You practice accessing the subtlest level of your mind, and then when your death does come, you're ready for it. You go through the process without losing consciousness. You go to subtle, very subtle level, and at that level where your mind is most potent, this is when you can get all the realizations. And so the yogis have been waiting for this time. It's the most marvelous time because their mind is so clear and so perfect and so capable at that time. So in this model of gross, subtle, and very subtle consciousness, at this level of gross, in our case, we're human, okay? So our gross consciousness is the grossest of the conceptuality and our sensory. And it's inextricably linked with this gross body, you know? You can't have eye consciousness, which is that part of your mind that cognizes shapes and colors, which itself is not physical, without an eyeball, you know? They intimately exist together. Then you've got subtle consciousness, and this we don't even posit as existing in our culture. When you stop breathing at the time of death, you go on to your subtle level. So at the subtle level, they talk about we've got subtle physical level, where they talk about we've got the subtle channels, 72,000 subtle channels. We have the subtle winds or pranas that our mind is inextricably linked to, and the subtle liquid energy, the red kundalini, the white kundalini. They talk about all this, okay? The subtle consciousness coming along with subtle physical energy. And then when you get to the very subtle level, the subtlest level of your own being, it's inextricably linked with a very subtle wind energy. And inextricable. That's just the way it is, you know. And these four elements are the same, effectively, as four elements as out there. So this body, it's the external world, the four elements. So the very way the four elements manifest for individual beings, whether it's disgusting or beautiful or ugly or violent or peaceful or harmonious or stinky or polluted or whatever. Either if you're a Christian, God did it this way. If you're a materialist, it's just got its own laws. But the Buddha's view is all the result of karma. So the collective karma, let's say, because lots of individual beings, you know, are part of a group and you all do something positive, then you end up living it together in this nice place, let's say. I mean, London seems to me a fairly reasonable place environmentally, meaning you don't have volcanoes every day. There's no sort of, you know, bushfires down the road. Australia get bushfires every minute. You've got, you know, you don't have vast floods. It seems to be, you know, the elements behave reasonably nice. It gets a bit chilly in the winter, gets a bit miserable in the summer, but fairly reasonable kind of middle of the road sort of behavior, all the elements. You understand, there's no big dramas. And so that's a collective karma, all people call Londoners, that where the elements basically behave nicely. And that's the fruit of your past collective actions done as a group, and it could have been a million lives ago as a group of people. Whereas you could be born in a group of people in San Francisco, and they have an earthquake, you know, collective karma. The people in the environmental karma, let's say September 11, or whatever you want to call here, whatever your business people have, terrorism and blah, blah, you know. Group of people experience things at a certain time, and the environmental doesn't just mean the four elements. Well, it does mean the four elements, but it doesn't just mean nature. It could be that you live in a stinky, rotten, cold house on one corner in some part of London, and it's all mouldy and yucky, and when the cold is really freezing and the hot is really boiling, whereas the person next door is a really peaceful environment. That's environmental karma. The food, you know, peanuts will kill you. That's environmental karma. So the way the four elements impact upon you, cause your past actions. Everything comes down to our past actions that program our mind, that then impact upon our own physical elements. As Lama Zopa says, they talk about it in great depth in the Kala Chakra Tantras, where he said roughly, the mind, when it's out of balance, which is where it's deluded, the deluded mind then pollutes the physical energies, which is what in turn karmically manifests as your sickness, which in turn then karmically over a long time impacts upon the external elements, which causes the imbalance of the external elements. That's for negative karma. Positive karma causes health, you know. I mean, Warren Buffett is like 86, you know, that rich bloke. He's 86 and his daughter says she's never seen water pass his lips. He eats hamburgers, ice cream and Coca-Cola. And he's 86 and he's fit as a fiddle. Well, he's got really good environmental karma, you know. I mean, somehow, you know, and he lives a long age, 86. That's the fruit of not killing others. So he's fat and healthy, bright, sharp as a needle still, keeps making money. So he's rich because he's generous. He's, you know, he's healthy because he hasn't killed. He has good environment because he hasn't killed. So he's really ticking off all the good boxes, you know. Then he's given all his money away to Bill Gates, so he's got plenty more generosity coming up. So who knows? He's quite a good bloke, really. All the result of his own past actions. We all create ourselves, collectively, individually, you know. You've got to admit it's a very interesting view. Yeah. Who would have thought, you know? And most people who are Buddhists don't study this. It's a brand new idea to many Buddhists, you know. So anyway, blah, blah. Does that answer your questions? Good. And so the whole idea here is too, the point about where this Tara practice fits in, if it is true, as Buddha is saying from his own observation, he didn't make it up, he's not speculating, it wasn't revealed to him, he's seen it for himself, that, you know, minds are beginningless, that every single thing a mind does produces its own experience, and that the delusions are adventitious, as we've been saying, then it logically follows you can become a Buddha, you know, it's logical deduction. So it's kind of a tasty view. Thank you for me, I'm happy to use this as my working hypothesis rather than other views. You know, so far so good is all I can say. I'm quite content with it, you know. So that's up to us, isn't it, whether we take on Buddha's views or not. And this is why for me it's so important that we're so used to thinking of religion as a belief system. You believe in it. But really, that's for Buddha, that's complete superstition. In the same way that when you go to school and your teacher tells you that 1 + 1 = 2, oh yeah, I believe in 1 + 1 = 2. Well, you can believe in it. It's helpful to you, but you only go so far with belief, can't you? If you don't understand it, then you're going to be very confused and you can't do anything else. You've got to go and ask the next, well, what's 1 and 7? Oh, what's 1 and 9? You can't work anything out for yourself because you haven't sorted out the laws. And this is what Buddha's saying, that karma is a natural law. Please hear the words. And if there's a law, you check this. If there's a law, we discover that numbers, is, you know, we can predict every time. Botany is a law. Engineering, there are laws. Architecture, there are laws. Everything we know in our world, we're pretty clever. We've discovered certain laws, and we know once there's a law, it's predictable. So that's how come we get buildings that stand up and computers that work. Every time you open your nice, you know, your Apple product, it's going to work because the laws are applying. You know, botany, you know, you put a rose here, you get a rose. So somehow we just think it's good luck and bad luck, or we think it's God who has a plan. And I'm not complaining about that one. But if you really do believe in God, excuse me, accept whatever God does, because he is the boss. You can't have it both ways. You can't moan and complain and then say God made the world. Because if God made the world, actually you should have faith in God. I think it's a perfect view, but it ain't the Buddha's view, that's all. He says it's not just some person up there running the show. He says it's not a possibility. And he says equally, it's not just random, which is the materialist one. No wonder we're all scared and freaked out. He says it's a natural law and minds do it. So it's all there. He's got it from his own experience. All the great beings over the centuries who've practiced this and have written the commentaries on it, brought it right down to the present. It's all there for us to look into, if we choose. We're the boss, not Buddha, you know. I find that quite an appealing idea. I rather like it. Obviously, I wouldn't be sitting here. I like Buddha. Cheers to Buddha. What else? What else? Yes, sweetheart. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, dear Lynn.
Hi, I'm just struggling a bit with the notion, so the two ideas in my head of that we come programmed.
Yes.
And we are in control.
Yep. Contradiction?
Seems to be.
Okay. Okay. The implication there, wouldn't you suggest the implication is if we're not programmed, what are we then? How would we be? How would it be? How would Lynn be if she weren't programmed with her own past tendencies? What would be in her, what would determine her choices? What would be determine the kind of parent she gets? What would determine the choices she makes? What would determine what she chooses to do in her life? What would determine all those things if she doesn't come programmed?
Yeah, no, I'm happy with the notion that we come programmed, but that to me implies that there is no choice anyway. So how do we then make choice to follow the Buddhist path, for example?
I see. Do you accept there's a law called botany?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you put a seed in the ground, you have to know the kind of seed it is, because based on the flower you want, and you will get that flower, won't you? So yep. That's a law. So the garden is the result of all the programming you put in there, isn't it? Would you agree? Okay.
Yeah.
So you can't have a rose unless you have put a rose seed. You can't have that, can you? You have to have it programmed and predictable that a rose seed is what produces a rose, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So let's say Lynn gets born to her nice mummy in England. She got born in England, did she?
Yeah.
Lynn, okay. So you came programmed with lots of qualities in the mind. Let's say you're a human, you are. So let's say you're a normal human, you've got a bit of anger program, a bit of jealousy, a bit of kindness, a bit of love, a bit of compassion, a bit of intelligence. Would you agree with those things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hope so.
So intelligence There's lots and lots of those seeds in there. We've got thousands of roommates in there. So in the Buddhist model of the mind, we've got three categories of states of mind, which are these thoughts in our mind. There is those that are negative, which are the deluded ones that are liars and neurotic and cause suffering and cause us to harm others. And then we have the ones that are virtuous. And so there's lots of those called love, compassion, patience, forgiveness. Then there's lots of others that they would actually say that are neither negative nor positive, which are really important to make us function. And there'd be one called short-term memory. Buddhism calls that mindfulness, like we've discussed, but Rami Yeshe would refer to as short-term memory, the ability to keep knowing what you're doing from moment to moment, okay? Now, thieves need that, and so do good Buddhists. Okay, so that's a very necessary state of mind. You have another one called discrimination, which is a type of intelligence that enables you to just say, that's red and that's blue, or to know that's good and that's bad. So if you have a bit of intelligence and a bit of mindfulness and a bit of, you know, concentration and a bit of patience and a bit of love and a bit of compassion, they're all the pieces of Lin that work hand in hand to enable Lin to make choices. And they're all karmic imprints in her mind from having done them before. So then the part that makes the choice is called intelligence. There's one part of your mind that is that hears about killing. You know, your ears hear about killing, and then all the bits of your mind that are working together, that are part of what's is called Lin, there's one there that's called a habit not to kill. There's another one called the habit to try and benefit others. They're all just states of mind. So they're all popping up. Then there's another one that's called discrimination, and you hear, oh, people kill. Well, straight away, all the bits of you will all, like a computer, all fall into place and all do their little bit, and Lin will come and Lin will end up saying, oh, that's not a very good idea. I don't think I will kill. So it's one part of your mind that says I won't kill, because mindfulness was working and concentration was working and discrimination was working. There's no absolute Lin in there that's doing this or that. All the bits of Lin work nicely because of habit and morality and this. They all work hand in hand, and Lin, the whole person called Lin, says I will not kill.
Thank you. I understand now, but I saw programmed as being kind of predetermined, but it's not. It's lots of different
it things. It is predetermined. Yes, botany predetermines your garden. There's no question. But there's no one I that is predetermined, therefore you're stuck on this track and you can't change. If you didn't have discrimination, but you had lots of anger and lots of wish to kill, and your discrimination was very weak, effectively you could say you can't choose to change. Look at the world. Animals can't access their discrimination. They can't access their intelligence. They're just overwhelmed by their ego grasping, their attachment, and their tendency to kill. So effectively, at the moment, they have zero choice, but they've still got those other tendencies, but deep down, but they're buried and they can't access them, which is why at the very least, as a human, we can access those parts, because we have programmed our mind with morality and goodness and kindness, and use our discrimination, our intelligence, for good purpose.
Great, thank you.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, thank you.
What else? Yes.
I was just wondering about the karma. I'm coming back to karma again. So
what, sweetheart?
I'm coming back to karma.
Yes, good.
Again. I was just wondering, you said that intentions kind of create our reality?
Well, intention, the word intention, you could say is a good translation of the word karma. And it's happening like a million miles a second. There's millions of them every second, very instinctive, very programmed. So intentions, yeah, we've got to start training our intention, yes. So then? It's one of many parts of our mind, but it's a good translation for the word karma to try and indicate. I was trying to get us to see how karma comes down to the mind, choosing things, making decisions.
So, but there's, like in Tibet, there were loads of people in Tibet.
Yes.
There were loads of people.
That's good. Keep that.
In Tibet, there were loads of people like having good intentions, obviously, or I guess so, at least. And still.
Bad things happened, yeah.
Bad things happen.
I understand, exactly.
So is there something like that, the collective intentions are like more important for the creation of reality than the individual?
I understand. No. So what's happening there is, what's your name?
Lawrence.
Lawrence. Okay. Basically, the people called Tibetan, let's say in the 1950s when Mr. Mao and his people came along and decided it was their country, so did all what they did. The group of people called Tibetans at that time, who at this time in their life, due to their strong past morality, got born as a Tibetan, access to a spiritual path, you know, wanted to be kind, didn't kill, didn't lie, didn't steal. Most of them, that was their morality. You know, they due to their own past morality, they got born to a mummy in Tibet. So they got a really good life, that they had really good tendencies, and so many became monks and nuns and didn't kill and didn't lie and didn't steal and so on and so forth. They were doing all that, for sure. They had really good experience karma, that people were nice to them, they had kind, they had good family, good friends, and they had not, you know, environmental karma wasn't too bad. It was pretty unpolluted and mightn't have been the fanciest environment. So pretty much they had the results of really good karma. Then along came Mr. Mao. Same people, still being good people, but their negative karma collectively, probably practiced 1,000 lives ago, 1,000,000 lives ago, began to ripen. When now collectively they got the result of their negative karma. Still in this life, they're still being good. So what they did in this life is not the cause of that. That's the fruit of seeds they planted a long, long time ago. So you be a good person and have bad things happen. You can be a bad person and have good things happen. Because it's all, what we're mainly, what who Lawrence is in this life, the cause of getting even Lawrence's mummy, being born wherever you were, was in the past life, even before you stopped breathing. Already the karmic seeds, we've got these banks, bank vaults of billions of seeds, you know, and highly complex, the whole system. At the time of your death, we can deduce that you are virtuous and peaceful. This triggered a virtuous karmic seed that programmed your consciousness to get to born to Lawrence's mummy's womb, wherever you were. Then at the same time, all the other karmic seeds that will be your personality, your tendencies, your experiences, and all the rest, they all ripened. This is all programmed, and you get born, and boom, and now you're living out all those seeds. All those seeds are ripening every moment, every moment, every moment. Everything that happens to you in this life, it's not possible that it was a seed you planted in this life. It's rare that something you plant in this life will ripen in this life. So the cause of that, the Tibetans' experience of being brutalized and their country ripped away and being murdered, was from countless lives ago. Countless. You can be healthy and eating good food every day and being kind to everybody and never killing a living being, and then one day you get cancer and die. That's from 20 lives ago, 30 lives ago, from nothing you did in this life. Does it make sense? Just as an idea. Okay. Yeah.
I have sort of two questions. One is, you say we have all the goodness and all the badness, but why is the badness so much louder?
Okay, darling, not complicated. what have you practiced? Have you got a profession?
I'm an artist and a theatre researcher.
A what?
Theatre researcher.
Okay, so you've got some expertise.
Yeah.
What would you say? Okay, what's your name?
Leora.
Leora?
Yes.
That's right, Leora, yeah. Why is Leora good at theatre research? Why is she so good at it? What's a simple, simple, simple answer? The simple answer?
Practice.
Because you practiced it. Yeah?
Yeah.
So if you put your hands on the piano and you play this amazing piece of Bach, we can deduce you've practiced it, can't we? It's the proof of the pudding, isn't it? So if you get angry really well and really easily, what do we deduce?
Because I've practiced it.
And if you're really loving and kind and compassionate, you've practiced it. Well then, darling, if you look into your life, if you look into your mind and you see that it's easier to be angry than patient, well, the reason is because you've practiced it. That's all. So maybe that's the common thing. We look at the world. But it doesn't follow with everybody. I mean, the little boy I keep mentioning, 3 years old, cries with compassion for the lice in his own head, and mummy hasn't taught him. We have to deduce that he had strong imprint not to kill and even had compassion for these lives. So whatever you look at yourself, whatever it comes easily, that's the proof you've practiced that. But the great part is that it's not set in stone and you can practice the other one. If you can even hear it, or access the seed, you know?
And that's the other part of my question.
Bit closer.
In your practice, how do you manage guilt? How do you manage guilt?
Okay, so let's analyze guilt. Guilt, His Holiness said one time, we do this purification practice, which we'll talk about later, it's very good to do, it's these four steps we go through. It's very practical to try and change our karma. The first one is called regret. And one time someone asked His Holiness, what's the difference between regret and guilt? And it was such a sweet answer. He said, guilt, well, you look in the past and you go, I did this, and I did that, and I did this, yeah? But then you go, and I'm a bad person, don't we? We're really good at it. We assume it's logical because I killed and lied and stole and cheated on my husband. I'm a bad person. We assume it's true. But it's an over-exaggeration of the truth. In just the same way, if you're mean and ugly to me, I'll go, you did this and you did that and you did this and you're a bad person. So that's anger, isn't it? I over-exaggerate the mean things you did and call all of you a bad person. That's a function of ego. It's the irony of ego. So guilt is self-hate or anger against self, just like anger is hating others, you know? And it's an automatic response of our ego at the moment. So we have to consciously argue with it. So regret is this very practical, based upon the view of karma, practical, brave attitude to acknowledge, as His Holiness says, you look into the past, you go, I did do that, and I did that, and I did this. You have to acknowledge that. But then you go, what can I do to change it? We have to practice that, because guilt, we naturally go to the one, I'm a bad person. But and we assume it's true, and it's very instinctive within us, and very old habit, in other words. We have to consciously change it. So either we have, our trouble is now, we either have guilt, or we have blame because we can't bear it, or we have denial, don't we? You know, we can't bear to look at the fact we did a bad thing because it's permanent, it feels so solid, we seem to think this is who I am. I mean, many of the friends I met in prison, because, you know, they kill people, they're in prison, they want to go kill themselves now because they think they're an evil person. And so the ones who like Buddhism, it blew their mind that there was no karma, as Buddha would say, that can't be changed. You're not set in stone. It doesn't define you. So we have to acknowledge that it's just because of a habit. And anyway, let's say I kill you. The karma between us is you must have killed me in the past, so you created the cause to get killed by me. I didn't have any control. I killed you back. I didn't, you know, oh, I didn't know what I did. Why did I do that? Well, I didn't know why it's karma. But if I have to acknowledge that I killed you before I then decide what to do about it, which means I then purify it, have compassion, and then vow never to kill again. That's how you change. But as long as I have guilt, I can't go past that. I'm just stuck in, I'm set in stone, and I'll just go kill myself eventually. If I have anger, rage and shout and kick, what good does that do? So we've got to acknowledge, it's just like if you've eaten poison. You just don't go, oh, I ate poison yesterday, oh, I'm such a bad person. Meanwhile, you're dying. I mean, we just don't, because we know, oh my God, what will I do about it? We'll quickly find the antidote. That's the same attitude here. So guilt is just this habit of ego. It's kind of ironic. It is a function of ego. And it's quite subtle to see this in the way Buddhist psychology talks, you know? We have to see it and uproot it, change it, argue with it every time until eventually we get the courage to own the simple fact, like everybody else, join the club, I've done dumb things. But hey, I'm sick of suffering, and that's got to be the reason why you want to regret, because I'm sick of suffering. I don't want to get this suffering from this poison. I don't want to have the suffering from past killing. So what can I do about it for my sake? Then I'll start thinking of compassion for others, and then I'll vow never to do it again, which is practical. Do you understand? But that's what we have to be aware of our own minds. It's all so instinctive, these habits. They're very deep, and we believe the stories so strongly, you know. And again, this is why these approaches, and why Lama Yeshe was so marvellous, teaching us this general sort of the psychology of Tantra, you know. Because you could see we're all these self-piteous, miserable people, and he'd try desperately to pick us up, he'd make us have parties, you know. He'd trying to get us to apply the philosophy in Tantra, which is, we're potentially Buddhas, you know, to identify. This is why Tantra is so powerful. Why doing these simple practices like we did this morning, which we'll do again in a minute and later after the break or whatever, or you practice, you know, purifying and then imagining you become the Buddha. It's just psychologically, it's so uplifting. Instead of I am bad, I'm hopeless, I'm this, I'm that all the time. We've got to identify, instead of the addiction of ego, the terrible irony of ego is we identify with the rubbish. You see, we either think, oh, I'm so special, and we puff ourselves up, or we think I'm a creep. We shrink ourselves down, you know. We can't win, you know. One is arrogance and one is low self-esteem, and we run between these like drunken sailors. But the reality, Buddha says, is we've got this extraordinary potential to be blissful and kind and wise and loving. That's kind of intense. So we better identify with that. This can lift our mind hugely and give us such courage, you know. This is why if you have this toolkit of your practice and you've done these different things, one day you need to give yourself a bit of a lecture, another day you do Tara practice. Lift your heart up, you know. Other days you'd be really ruthless with yourself and do a bit of arguing. There's different tools for different purposes, and they're all based on their psychology, Buddhist psychology, and all are tools to help us get to our own amazing potential, you know. But to have the courage, this is part of the problem. We're so, really the irony of ego is, we don't like to point out our good qualities. We're embarrassed. The first thing out of our mouth is our misery, you know. First thing out is our negativity, our guilt. We can't bear the pain of the guilt. So we have to give it to someone else. It's too unbearable. We're so addicted to seeing our mistakes all the time, but then concretizing them, and that's the worst part. Seeing them is great, but we over-exaggerate them. Just like we see other people's faults, but we over-exaggerate them. I always remember reading that Martin Luther King was amazing, blew my mind. He said, it's all right to see, to be angry. He meant to see fault. There's racism, there's this, there's that. You need to see it, that's wisdom. You need to see your own rubbish, that's wisdom. But then he said about the world, it's okay to find fault, but then you say, what can I do to help? Not just shout and yell and scream. That makes you crazy, and guilt is that internalized. So this other one of seeing our good qualities, I mean almost, you know, we do this practice at the end of the day called purification. You regret, you have compassion, you do a practice and then you determine not to do it again. It's like your own reprogramming yourself. But I think even after that, we should finish the day with, they call it rejoicing. It sounds so cute, you know, rejoice in your good qualities. Oh, yeah. We're just addicted to our misery, you know. We think it's almost a virtue in pointing out our badness. But we're stuck in it. So it takes great courage to point out your good qualities. You did make effort. You didn't badmouth every person you met today. You did control your mouth once. You didn't kill that ant, you made an effort. That's really incredible. Delight in that. But we find that very nerve-wracking. We love other, we want other people to praise us. Look, we're hungry like vampires. But look what happens when they do. Oh, come on, that's not true. No, I don't believe that. We want them to say it again and again and again, but we never believe it. But one person says one bad word about you, you run like a magnet. It's the truth. This shows the irony of our ego, you know. This is why ego is not some big, fancy, strong thing. Ego, the irony of ego is it's self-loathing. It's addicted to misery, you know. So that's why Tantra, this simple, ordinary level, don't make it all fancy term, Tantra, you know. These simple, marvelous practices of identifying with your future potential. Visualize as a blissful female Buddha or a blissful male, whatever you like, you know. Different psychological qualities, which is all they are in the end. It's very, very empowering. Good for our minds, you know. Yeah. Any other questions that came up in the discussion? Where are you? Yes, sweetheart, where's the mic, please?
Yeah. I think the whole idea of karma is quite new to
me.
Is it?
Okay.
I think my way of kind of maybe trying to deal with things is to try and understand maybe why someone behaved the way they did.
That's
or
right.
Why something happened.
Yep.
And I'm sort of thinking, is karma then the answer to the questions you couldn't find an answer for? So in trying to understand, for example, my family and why maybe they are the way they are, the way I am, the way I am.
Yes.
If I can't explain it by any other means, should I assume it's karma?
Well, that's very much, yes, really the way to put it is, you've got the materialist explanation of things, which is what we're mostly brought up with. Even if we're Christians or something, we still get the scientific view, don't we, that mummy made me, daddy made me, it's the genes, the DNA. You understand that the behaviour, all this is the model we all work with very deeply, very instinctively. So, of course, if it's true that your mother and father created you, then it's sort of logical that, you know, to not know why all of a sudden you walk down the street and someone punches you in the nose. Or indeed, why you walk down the street and someone, or at somewhere, someone gives you $1 million. We don't mind that one, though. We don't care why good things happen. We agonize about why the bad things happen. We never care about why good things happen. We just think it's our right, you know. But equally, the same thing. There's no explanation in normal terms why you meet a rapist or why you win the lottery. So we just call it good luck and bad luck. So the Buddha says there's no such thing. It's a natural law. If you're a really devoted Christian, like I said, it's all God's will and you accept. But most Christians don't do that with respect. Do you understand? We moan and complain. It's a pretty big one, that actually. It's huge. But the Buddhist one is, it's just like in a garden. If you've got a garden in front of you, no matter what's in it, no matter how evil, how junky, how divine, you just know logically it's there because you sowed the seeds, if it's your garden. So our life is our garden. And there's an explanation, the Buddha says, for every single thing in it because it's a natural law, which is an interesting view because we don't think of life like this. So everything you are is the fruit of what you have done. You are the fruit of your own morality. You've got a human birth because of past morality. You've got people who love you because you were kind to them. You have people who abuse you because you've abused them. You have people who believe your words even if you're lying because you've spoken the truth in the past. You have people who don't believe your words even if you're speaking the truth because you lied in the past. You have people who don't pay their debts because you stole in the past. It sort of sounds cliched, but it's kind of not illogical as a concept, you know. Every one of us, every individual being, your mummy, your daddy, and then the group and how you interact with each other, whether you abuse each other or help each other, it's due to past relationships, past way we harmed each other and helped each other. Yes.
I guess then, does that mean it can help us to forgive ourselves and other
That's
people?
That's the point, sweetie pie. Yes, it's an immense relief. Because join the club, honey. Join the club, you know. And you can eventually, you know, forgive your horrible daddy, let's say. Because we know, I mean, there's always this story I tell. It's good to say extreme examples. There's this years ago, 2003, I was invited to this conference. Richard Gere invited. He was working with some ex-prisoners. He had a meeting of all these ex-prisoners, all of whom had done some kind of work in prison, spiritual meditation. I'd been running a non-profit, so I was invited, and 20 former prisoners, Americans, in New York, and Dalai Lama was invited to give teachings, and they met him and everything. It was a very moving day. Black, white, Puerto Rican, Mexican, all these different Americans, all with their experiences of suffering and dramas and their incarceration, the racism and the blah, blah, and they'd all done some kind of meditation. So it was very nice discussing all their problems, you know, and how they're dealing with them. So they also invited, Richard Gere also invited two young Tibetan nuns who'd been tortured and sexually abused in prison for a couple of years in Lhasa, whatever, you know, for being Tibetan nuns, basically, nice girls, young girls. So they were very interesting because they were telling about their experience. And it was, first of all, I think it was very evident to everybody else in that room that if you wanted to quantify suffering, there's probably, you know, they won the lottery, the most suffering, if you could quantify it. But what was most fascinating, and this is an interesting byproduct of having the view of karma, is they were not angry. And this is very confusing. We either, when we have, say, abuse from other people, you either get guilty, and this is very common, you know, very, very common. My sister Judy is a lawyer in Melbourne. It's kind of big at the moment, all the, you know, the exposing of the Catholic Church for all the paedophilia. And all, you know, all the numbers of, she's writing a whatever, all the numbers of people who committed suicide, the victims, you know. So, or you get angry. You blame yourself or you blame others, which is very, depending on your personality, isn't it? So these two young women, they weren't angry, and they didn't seem to express the guilt either. They didn't have that kind of anguish. And the reason is, the logical reason is, because when you think that you're made by your mother and father, if you have that as your view, it's logical that there is no explanation why bad things would happen to you. Equally the good, we don't mind about those, like I said. There is no explanation. It just seems to be luck, isn't it? Would you agree? So then it can cause enormous anguish. Why is this happening to me? Which is the major reason most people suffer, and we can't get past it because, as you just pointed out, there's no explanation. And that's what makes us all insane. We don't know why. We're like stay wide-eyed in horror and panic. Why? That's why when we look at suffering on this earth, some people just can't bear the pain. The compassion is too much because we don't know why. And therefore, we're utterly overwhelmed by it. Do you understand? So these young women, they were very clear. They were sad. Tears came, but they weren't angry. And they finished their little talk very quietly, very humbly. They said, of course, we had compassion for our torturers because we knew that we must have harmed them in the past. So that's their philosophical view that they use in their life to explain their reality. And I can only say from my, you know, person who's chosen to be a Buddhist, having come from being a Catholic and everything, which I really respect, that it's been the most empowering thing is this view of karma, an explanation. In my own mind, with a sort of my mind, I've always wanted the big picture. I always wanted to understand why. When I was into God when I was a kid, I loved the vision of God and view and how, what, where, whatever. Then I decided you can't have boys and God, so I gave up God and went for boys, you know, whatever. But then finally came to be a Buddhist, and I think the view of karma was one of the first. I didn't understand what Lama Zopa said for one whole month in this course I did, but I remember the word karma, and I wanted to know about that. And for me, this is the explanation of why things are. Okay, one has to go into it very deeply because it's so utterly different. In its assumptions, it's so different as an explanation. We've got to really put all the pieces together. But I find it extremely empowering because for me that meant I've come with my potential. I've come with my junk, but with my good as well. And it's not set in stone. therefore I can forgive me, and therefore for sure I can forgive my father. Let's say in my case, my father, for the various things he did to me. Falling off a log takes time, but it's an explanation. And it seems to me, when we don't know why things happen, that's so much of the cause of so much terrible suffering, because ignorance is really fear. You understand? I mean, it takes a time to see if it's true or not, but we've got to start with a hypothesis. For sure, the Buddhist view would be that it does explain. But we've got to, you know, study it and think about it and put all the nuts and bolts together, not just say, oh, it's karma. It's not enough, you know. We've got to try and explain it. And all the teachings, it's all there to be explained. Do you understand? Yeah. And then, of course, again, we can see how that fits completely with this view that we're discussing here, you know, about seeing yourself as a Buddha, these marvelous practices. Which actually leads me to, well, as we mentioned this morning, one of the crucial prerequisites or for qualifications for doing these practices is the understanding of emptiness, you know, which is the real wisdom teachings of the Buddha. And so the more we can understand karma, which is really Buddha's, an example of the way Buddha talks of the law of dependent arising, that everything comes into existence and exists in dependence upon various factors, and that proves, it's the king of logics, as Lama Yeshe puts it, it proves that therefore there is no thing from its own side as this or that. That everything is the product of dependent arising, which is that therefore there's nothing from the side of the thing that makes it this or that. So these teachings, you know, Buddha's teachings on what they call the two truths, all the teachings as we practice it gradually and slowly are leading us to this understanding of the way that things do exist, in the kind of the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of how things exist. And this is what's, you know, many people who study Buddhism find this so appealing, but also a bit esoteric, and we sort of make it again a bit mystical, you know. But it's a very, very practical, down-to-earth kind of understanding of the way things exist. So karma, cause and effect, I am who I am as a result of what I've done, is a marvelous logic to prove, therefore, there is no me, good, bad, or anything else from its own side, you know. And this is the point about ego. The grasping at the self, this grasping so primordially at a self-existent me, these are the words they use, is what is the sense of self that's set in stone, that necessarily is deluded and miserable, that this is the source of all suffering, and therefore, and as Lama Zopa says, when we've realized emptiness, and we'll go into these words now, when we realize emptiness, when we realize there is no I from its own side, there is no bad from its own side, there is no good from its own side, when we loosen the grip of this grasping, when we finally seen the truth, as the Buddha would say, the absence of that fantasy self, as Rinpoche says, there is no fear. We've eliminated fear. So the way Buddha talks, when you study Buddhist psychology, the Buddhist model of the mind, which is really quite distinct, you know, as I mentioned briefly several times, you look into the mental consciousness, the mind, the mental consciousness. We have sensory consciousness, the eye consciousness functioning through the medium of the eyeball and so on and so forth, you know, cognizes shape and colour. Ear consciousness cognizes sound. But they're just kind of like dumb animals, you know. They already lead us up garden paths. They're very limited. The senses are very limited in their capacity for cognition. The mental consciousness, as Lama Zopa puts it, that's where the workshop is. You know, they point here when they say mental consciousness. The mind, that's where the workshop is. This is what we have to become deeply familiar with. This is where we have to learn to be our own therapist. Because the contents of the mental consciousness, this is the source of all happiness and all suffering. And this is where the changes have to happen. And that's why we need single-pointed concentration, the techniques of mindfulness, as they're called, you know, to help us focus. And we need to learn Buddha's model of the mind, and we use these two tools, and then we begin to investigate this mind of ours. So in this mental consciousness of ours, according to this Buddhist model of the mind, you've got these, as we mentioned before to Lynn, you've got three categories of states of mind. It's not complicated. You've got states of mind that are called virtuous or positive. You've got states of mind that are called non-virtuous or negative. Then you have a whole bunch, and there's millions of them, that are called neither of those. But it doesn't mean they're not important. Like I mentioned, there's one called mindfulness, there's one called concentration, there's one called discrimination. There's so many of these that are like, I like to call them like the plumbing of the mind. In their nature, they're neither negative nor positive, but they're crucial. So whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need them to do a job well, you know? That's why in their nature, they're not virtuous. That's what virtuous means in its nature. It's got a positive quality about it. So this is a very distinct to Buddha's view. So negative states of mind are the ones that cause the problems. The negative states of mind. They have two main characteristics. They are deeply disturbing, and they're known as disturbing emotions. They're deeply disturbing to you, not to mention others, to you having them. And the really specific function. And when we get this one, this is the key to understanding the way Buddha talks about the mind, and therefore the key to understanding how these delusions are adventitious, and therefore the key to understanding emptiness and understanding how we can become Buddha, how we can become Tara. It all fits logically, you know? So this other characteristic, and this is indicated by one of these other words, that is a synonym for disturbing emotion, afflictive emotion, negative state of mind. You read about it all the time in the literature. This other word is delusion. And this is interesting, I've noticed in other languages. I think in Hebrew they don't have one, do they? Delusion. Is there a word for delusion in Hebrew?
I mean, there is a word that, you know.
But it's not exactly the same one, is it? I've seen in most languages it's not a really good translation. What? Anyway, never mind. Okay, he's from Israel. So in English it's a great word. It's so precise in expressing Buddha's exact meaning, and it's something that we might intend to think of, and I've been saying it already several times. This word delusion, like if someone says to you, we know, well, in English, God, you're so deluded or delusional, we will know they mean you're not in touch with reality, isn't it? And it's a perfect word. This is so perfect. This hits it on the head with what Buddha's saying. Like I said before, these neuroses, and he would like that word too, these unhappy emotions, these afflictions, as you read a lot in the literature, afflictions, these negative states, these disturbing emotions, they're all referring to the same thing. This hierarchy of these neuroses, the root delusion, which is what we're getting to here, as I mentioned already, it's simply called ignorance. But it's in Tibetan, ma rigpa. Unawareness. Rigpa is awareness, ma is the negation. So it's unawareness. So it's a kind of interesting word, boring old word, you know. Unawareness of what? Ignorance of what? Well, this kind of ignorance, as His Holiness points out, it's kind of, he doesn't say this word, but I'm saying it, it's double trouble. If you were ignorant, if I said to you, what's that? What colour's that? And you go, blue. No, sorry, you go, I don't know. Well, that's ordinary common garden ignorance, isn't it? You just don't know what the colour is. And that's easy to fix. We'll just say, oh, that's red. You go, oh, thanks a lot. Great, now it's easy. But this ignorance is ignorant of how things exist, so it doesn't know how things actually exist in the ultimate way. So it's got that problem. But it's got this other terrible problem on top, which is why it's so hard to remove from our mind. And this ignorance is known colloquially as ego grasping. It's, as I mentioned already, this ignorance, this marigpa, it's a primordially held, deeply instinctive, terrified grasping at a sense of self. Independent, real, solid, independent, inherent, intrinsic, solid, definite, permanent, me. So it's completely ignorant of how I do exist, but the trouble is, it's made up its own completely ridiculous story. So it's like bad enough just to say you don't know what it is, but that's easy to fix. You just say it's red and you've now got no longer ignorance. But if you think it's blue, you're in big trouble. So you believe it's blue, it appears to you blue, you'll fight to the death to your right to see it as blue. Right? So not only do you not know it's red, but you think it's blue. So that's the double trouble ignorance. This ignorance is like that. Not only does this ignorance deepen our bones, this is the root delusion they call it, not only does it not know how things actually exist, which is how Buddha talks, it doesn't know that everything's interdependent, it doesn't know that everything is empty of existing inherently, which is a truth, Buddha says, the way he describes wisdom. It not only doesn't know that, but it's made up his own ridiculous story, which is the exact opposite to truth. So we've got to start dragging, ripping our mind to pieces, unpacking all the lies in the mind in order to even begin to hear the truth. And this ego grasping, the Buddha says, is eons old. It's deeply primordially instinctive. And it's the root delusion, which then gives rise to effectively the main cause of our suffering in day-to-day, which we talked about, attachment, this bottomless pit of craving and neediness, completely convinced that I haven't got enough, no matter what I get is never enough, and no matter what I do it's never enough, and I am never enough. So it's always dissatisfied, that's its disease, therefore always hankering after something more. And then the millisecond it doesn't get what it wants, anger arises, or guilt, or despair, or depression. And then jealousy, arrogance, and all the other variations on top. This is what being in samsara means for the Buddha, being caught up in all this nonsense. And all this nonsense has two functions. One, it's hideously disturbing and distressing. It's mental illness, basically. And second, it's a bunch of rotten lies. And this is the part that's hard to see. So, and the basic way all these delusions lie, there's a fundamental way they lie, a bare bones way. They lie in terms of exaggerating certain aspects of the object. So we discussed attachment. When I'm in love with Fred, my attachment grotesquely exaggerates his divineness. When I hate Fred, my anger exaggerates his ugliness. We know this. This is normal life. We so take it for granted. And then the trouble is, as Lama Zopa says, bad enough that I think the chocolate cake will make me happy, which is a big lie. It's just attachment gone mad, believing the cake looks so divine, believing when I eat it I'll get happy. Bad enough I believe it's that. But the worst thing is, no, bad enough I see it that way. Bad enough we see things the way they don't exist. Bad enough we see everything in the way they don't exist. But the worst thing is we believe it's true. This is Buddha's main one. This is the wisdom teachings of Buddha. And they're so interesting. And as we get to see our own minds, we get to see beyond the emotional component, like I said before, we're going to see the delusional aspect. So the thing is, though, we're all deluded. It's just a question of degree. If you read, like I said yesterday before, TikTok's ravings on a piece of paper, say he's completely psycho, let's say, remember, and you read his ravings, you would say this man's delusional, wouldn't you? Because you can really see he's exaggerating, everyone's a monster and all these evil people and all trying to kill him. We'll say the poor man's deluded. But normal people with normal anger, we just say, oh, they're angry, you know. When they calm down, they're normal again. But that's a mental illness. They're delusional too. But it's just a question of degree, you know. And I'm not joking now, which is a bit of a shocking point here, because we so assume attachment and anger, grasping at a self and having fear of its attacked. We assume these are healthy, normal states of mind. We defend our right to have them. In fact, we would so defend our right to have them, like I mentioned before, we would assume we're abnormal if we didn't have them. Buddha says they're deep mental illnesses. And this is all he's saying. This is how Buddha's on about. But we so mystify with all these nice Indian words and Tibetan words, and we say the words like samsara, you know, it sounds like a holy thing, you know. But being in samsara for the Buddha means being caught up in these neuroses. And everybody's got them. It's just a question of degree. And Buddha says, remember, they're adventitious. And this is what's so tough. So this ignorance is the root one, the biggest liar of all, that pervades all the others. All the others are underpinned by this root delusion. So these words, understanding emptiness, realizing emptiness, which we'll talk about, which we are talking about, which is crucial to really do these practices like Tara. Unpacking and understanding emptiness, when we've begun to see this, this is the method for ridding the mind of neuroses and ridding the mind of suffering and ridding the mind of fear. Because fear, it's interesting, in Buddhist psychology, fear is not given a status as a particular delusion because all the delusions are in the nature of fear. Fear is the nature of all delusions. Fear is the nature of attachment, anger, ego grasping, pride, low self-esteem, guilt, you name it. They are dripping in fear. Fear is their nature, which is kind of interesting, you know. So when you realize emptiness, when you've seen the truth, Buddha says, when you've uprooted these misconceptions, when you've seen the reality of how things exist interdependently, there is no longer any fear, which is kind of interesting. I rather look forward to it. Sounds good. So, okay, so in relation to seeing myself as Tara, without this view that everything is empty of inherent existence, which I want to unpack, without this view that I'm not stuck in who I am, then seeing yourself as Tara will be absurd. Like I said, if there is a definite feeling of I am Robina, I'm born as Robina, I'm an acorn, I will be an acorn, I'm always an acorn, and I'll die as an acorn, like we mentioned, then it's absurd to think you can be an oak tree, isn't it? You see yourself, you see an oak tree, and there's no relationship between you and the acorn, because you don't see the relationship, you can't understand it. So it would be absurd to try and imagine yourself as an oak tree. You have no methods. Whereas then to think of ordinary Robina, ordinary deluded Robina with anger and jealousy and depression, can become a Buddha, which is a mind that's fully developed, that sees reality as it is, that sees the minds of all beings, infinitely, that's omniscient, that's infinitely compassionate, infinitely wise, infinitely powerful, that can exist for countless eons, benefiting sentient beings. It sounds like insanity. And it can see no relationship between an ordinary mind and this. This is why, again, if we want interested in Buddhism, interested in these practices, to even understand intellectually how it fits as a kind of a coherent presentation. Because let's face it, I find this point very important. If, you know, you could be an allopathic person all your life, never heard of acupuncture, then you hear these weird people put needles in you, you know? Then you keep hearing about acupuncture. Then slowly, you know, you've got to open your mind to the possibility it could be reasonable. But you can't sort of squeeze acupuncture into the Western model. It won't work because there's a series of different assumptions, isn't it? So completely different. So you've got to have the courage to put aside your own theories in order to look into the theories of acupuncture. And that means you've got to study it first intellectually. You've got to understand it. And my feeling is, if you think of it this way, if it is valid, it's got to be coherent. You could study acupuncture perfectly intellectually, without putting a needle in anybody. And if you do, it should be intellectually coherent. That's reasonable, it seems to me. Well, the same here. Buddhism is not just kind of be mindful here and do that there and think of karma if you feel like it. You can, of course, you're the boss. But if it is not a big overview, a coherent system, then it's a load of rubbish. It's just superstition, you know, which is how we think of religion, unfortunately. Which I find appealing, because that's why I, for myself personally, like this Tibetan monastic and, you know, situation, which is where my teachers have come from, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the Lama here, Lama Zopa, Lama Yeshe, they come out of that system, where there's this big picture, the view, you know, of how things exist, what is the mind, what is karma, and like any system, if the more you study this, the more helps you with that. The more you study that, that helps you with this bit. The more you hear that bit, that helps you with that bit. If it's a coherent system, and that's for us to find out, you know. I find that very appealing. Which is why I always like to talk about the big picture. Okay. So let me go into emptiness a bit, and then we have a break, and then we can do the Tara practice again. All right? Okay. And this is a really crucial one. You've got to have renunciation, like we talked. You've got to have bodhicitta. That's the basis. But without emptiness, it's all nonsense. It's all a joke, you know. Okay. So maybe you've never heard about emptiness before, in which case do your best, and if you have, then let's unpack it, because I think one of the biggest problems we've all got when we read the Tibetan teachings, read the Japanese, read the Indian, because they're so respectful of the system, they repeat the words they've heard, and then you begin to internalize those words. But the system, the way of talking is, you know, medieval. When I first heard the teachings from Lama Zopa Rinpoche's mouth, you know, this Lam Rim, this whole package, I sat there, I understood his words, I could not understand what he was talking about. It was this arcane, strange packaging. I kept saying to myself, where's the Buddhism? I couldn't understand a thing. It was completely confusing to me. Because so much of it is the terminology is so different, the structure, the concepts, the way of talking, you know, so very different. So like when you hear Buddhists talk about we've all got Buddha nature, the number of interpretations of that. But if you hear the way the words are used, like we described with the acorn, like I said, you could say, logically, all acorns possess oak tree nature. When you hear that, it gives us an insight into the way the words are used. That all acorns, by definition, are potential oak trees. That's the point here. It's what defines an acorn, isn't it? Its potential to be an oak tree. It's what defines its existence. That's the point that's so fundamental for the Buddha, that all minds possess Buddha nature. All minds, by definition, are potential Buddhas. And the proof of this is emptiness. In fact, they talk about ultimate Buddha nature. That means the emptiness of your mind. That's the proof. Okay, these words are meaningless to us right now. Let's unpack them. But the way they talk the words. Ultimate Buddha nature is referring to the emptiness of your mind. So what the Buddha says, why things exist is because they are empty of existing from their own side. How come they can exist is because they're empty of existing from their own side. So these words are too much for us. You know, we hear this and we go, oh yeah, so esoteric. So first of all, the word emptiness, even this word is so puzzling to us, you know. Forget what it, empty of what, but just the use of the word is so helpful to understand, necessary to understand. The simple word empty, emptiness, empty. Don't make it esoteric, it's not. You know, ordinary words. I'd look at my cup and go, uh-oh, it's empty. Because we understand cups and what cups are supposed to hold, we know it's empty of tea, not like of knives or elephants or something. You'd know it means empty of tea or whatever I drink, isn't it? So it's you walk in the room, uh-oh, it's empty. We know it doesn't mean of furniture. We usually mean it means of people. We know that it's just our common language. So empty has the simplest meaning of then something not being there. That's all. Nothing cosmic. Something is not there. And you have to usually know what's not there to get the meaning of the person's sentence, isn't it? The cup is empty, you know. I'm feeling so empty. It means there's sort of no feelings and they're a bit depressed. And that's just casual language, how we talk. Okay, so what's Buddha telling us? Things are empty. And of what? Obviously, it's got to be empty of something, isn't it? Reasonable. So that's why with all this shorthand, you know, you learn the shorthand, but you've got to get to unpack it carefully. So Buddha says he wants us to realize emptiness. We hear those words. You've got to see emptiness. We've got to realize emptiness. Okay. What's he mean? Just use the word first. Forget about what he is referring to, which is he wants us to understand that everything is empty of existing inherently. Forget that part. Just look at the word emptiness first, because I think this, understanding the way they use the word, can be extremely helpful. So, all right. Again, here we have our thermos. Let's say you see blue when you see this thermos. Now, then we'll go, well, how do you know it's not blue? We'll say, well, most people in this room, would you agree it's red, yeah? So in other words, we all know the English language. We all know the word red refers to this colour. Our glasses are working, our eyes are working, the lighting is okay. And we'll all go, yeah, that's red. Seems pretty simple, doesn't it? So we agree with that. And this is even something interesting, even the way we establish this. Why is it red, you'll say? Well, we've all agreed it's red. And this is really how things do exist, finally, Buddha says. It's by convention. We all agree. We label something, we define it, then we all shake hands, and we agree that that's called red. It could have been called ooh-ah, couldn't it? But we call it red, don't we, in the English language. So we all agree. Simple. Just conventionally, it's known as red. That's conventional truth. That's red. So let's say I'm colorblind, and I see blue. So, you know, the normal thing would be you'd fight with me and bully me into seeing I'm wrong. It's not blue, Rabino, it's red, you know. Oh, all right, it's red. But I keep seeing blue, so I'm in big trouble. I've got a conflict. So the thing is, you wouldn't bully me. What would you do? You would probably, you'd know, obviously, I've got either my English is weird, my glasses don't work, my eyes don't work, or the lighting doesn't work. It's not that complicated. So you'd try and sort out the problem, wouldn't you? And maybe I've got cataracts, who knows? Let's say. So then what happens when you fix my eyes and fix the glasses and I look again and I've seen this as blue all my life, I believe totally that red is blue, and now you fix the problem now, what will I see when I look again? What will I see? Huh? Precisely. Lynn said it. You wouldn't see red. Okay, if you believe this is blue all the time, all your life, you've believed it's blue, right? Don't you think you'd get a shock when you look again, you didn't see blue? You'd get a shock, wouldn't you? Another good example I like to use, I use it. You got your keys in the key drawer by the front door. They always belong in the key drawer. And you're running late and you rush out and you open the drawer. Oh, my God. What do you think you saw in that drawer? What do you think you saw in that drawer? Huh? Emptiness of keys. use a simple word, you'd say, oh my God, where are my keys? There's no keys there. But have a look at this. Putting it as a noun, what you saw in that drawer, listen to this carefully, you agree, is the absence of keys. It's quite a shock, isn't it? So in other words, when you expect keys, you with me? You get a big shock when you see no keys, wouldn't you? So you just go, if I just stuck my nose into your drawer and I opened it, I'd just go, oh, what a boring old drawer, nothing in there. I wouldn't see the emptiness of keys, would I? Why? Because I didn't expect keys. So this is the point Buddha's making. Let's say, you know, your husband left you for a younger version. And I don't know you have Fred. I've never met Fred. I don't know about Fred. But Fred has left you for a younger version. You go home. What do you see in that house every day? What do you feel in that house every day? Absence of Fred, isn't it? Isn't it unbearable? Or he goes and dies on you. Are you sort of getting my point here? I'm trying to establish this very vivid thing called the absence of something, which is quite a vivid thing for the person who wants it to be there or who expects it to be there, who thought it was there, but for whom now you see it's not. Are you kind of getting my idea? It's a very vivid thing, isn't it? The absence of those keys is a shock. You don't see an empty drawer. It's quite shocking. You will see emptiness of keys. And this is getting to the point now. When we hear the word emptiness in general, we just go, oh, well, there's no eye. So I check out the ears, and I check out the eyes, I check out the anger, check out the anger. There's nothing left. There's no eye. That's wrong. It's not like that. It's not like that. It's wrong. It's not like that, okay? It's like you check out all the things out of the drawer. Oh, there's an empty drawer. No. Emptiness of keys is a very specific, really vivid, listen to these words, really vivid phenomenon that does exist in your drawer. Can you kind of hear the point? You turn this emptiness, which sounds nihilistic, into a very vivid thing that's a knowable object, a knowable phenomenon that your mind can see. The absence of keys, it's stupendous. Well, here, the same. You believe this is blue. You expect it to be blue. And suddenly you go, oh, you don't see red at all at first. You go, oh, my God, it's not blue. So you just cognize the emptiness of blue. Can you hear the use of the word? This is the way the word emptiness is used. That's why it's such a vivid thing. That's why Buddha says we have to realize emptiness of inherent I. Forget the inherent I yet. Don't worry about that. So another way of putting it is, for eons, Buddha says, we've been believing in a fantasy I. Well, let's call it the inherent I. Don't worry what it means yet. We've been believing 1,000,000,000% in an inherent I. Totally assumed, everything is based upon that assumption, all our lives, all of samsara, all of suffering, all of dramas, all of future lives, all based on the assumption of a particular kind of I, an inherent I. And all Buddha's saying is, hey baby, no such one exists. So bad enough, you see blue where there's not. You think there are keys where there aren't any, or that you expect keys, is the idea. So to see, to get to cognize directly, to realize the absence of that I that you thought was there. Can you hear the words? So the emptiness of something is not a nihilistic statement at all in any way possible. It's absurd. But the whole thing to get it is to get a sense of the emptiness of something being a thing that exists. As Lama Zopa puts it, he would say, the absence of blue... Okay, this is the words they use again. It seems odd to us. You listen to the words. Do you accept that red exists on this thermos? So we don't talk this way, but can you see that red does exist on this thermos? Yeah? Can you agree, once you've removed the delusion from your mind, that the absence of blue does exist on this thermos? Yes. There's a phenomenon called red, and there's a phenomenon called absence of blue, isn't there? Sort of like equal status. It seems abstract, but it's only relevant if you think it's blue. I mean, this room is also empty of elephants, isn't it? But it's stupid unless you think there are elephants here, isn't it? You don't say it. It's just clever. It's clever stuff. It's silly. If you believe there's an elephant in the room, then you're going to walk in the room, you will see the emptiness of elephants, for sure. Do you get my... Are you seeing what I'm saying here? So the emptiness of something in the way that Buddha's talking is a very vivid thing that does exist. And that's why emptiness can never mean nihilism. We tend to think, oh, well, I believe there's an I, and then Buddha says there's no I, so I chuck out all the bits of I, and there's nothing left. That's the nihilistic view. And even as Buddhists, we say, oh, well, it's empty. It's all empty anyway. It doesn't matter. That's a mistake. It's not like that. It just isn't like that. It's quite a specific point. And once we get a head around the use of the words, it can be very helpful. So You know, in the Heart Sutra, it says form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is nothing other than emptiness, emptiness is nothing other than form. Meaning, you cannot possibly have... Okay, forget the emptiness now, look at this. Would you agree we know what we've all talked about, we've all seen red in the past, haven't we? So we can just have a very general discussion about what red's like, can't we? We can visualize different reds, we can remember our red jacket, our red this. We can talk about it in general, you agree? Red. But if you want a direct experience of red, what do you need in front of you? A thing that possesses red as a characteristic, a red object. So there you go. We can talk about it, and now we have an actual experience of red, don't we? You agree?
Yeah.
Okay. You agree that we can talk about your mistake? Oh no, we agree that we can talk about Buddha's teachings on emptiness. We can talk about there is no I from its own side, there's no intrinsic I, blah, 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 all the birds, all independent, blah, 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 all the words you learn, you know. We can talk about that in general, can't we? Yeah, you agree? So now, if you want a direct experience of the absence of inherent existence, what do you need in front of you? Repeat the word you said before.
Object.
An object that possesses what?
The ability
to be. The way to put it would be, you need in front of you a phenomenon, a self. Okay, you can talk about the emptiness of Rabina, okay? We're discussing the emptiness of Rabina. And we tend to think it means nihilistic. We can discuss it. How Rabina, myself, yourself are empty of inherent existence, okay? So we can talk about that generally. So you, in order to have a direct experience of the empty of emptiness of inherent existence of a self, what do you need in front of you? Okay, that's jumping to the conclusion. In order to have an experience of the emptiness of inherent existence of self, what do you need in front of you? A self. So you can't possibly say there's no self. You can't possibly have emptiness of blue without a red thermos, can you? Okay, it's just to try to get our head around how the absence of something is a vivid thing that exists rather than it sort of means nothingness, that's all. Slowly we get used to the idea. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's it got to do with anything now, really?
That's right. Well, that's a good question, isn't it? If you've not, that's the point. The point is, very simple. It's very simple, darling. It's got to do with everything.
Yeah.
It's got to do with everything. What's your name?
Vanessa.
Vanessa, okay. Buddha says, Vanessa, yeah, that you, in your mind, you have believed, since beginningless time, in an inherent I. Okay, you don't know you believe in this, and we don't. That's why things sound so boring. What's it got to do with anything? It's a very good question. It just sounds abstract, doesn't it? Darling, it's wonderful. It's perfect. You understand my point?
Yeah.
It sounds, because it's so abstract to us, it sounds meaningless. It doesn't touch us at all, does it? It just sounds intellectual, yeah? Okay. Can you understand the idea that you can see blue where there isn't blue? Can you get that idea? You understand the idea that you can see things that don't exist, like you believe that Fred is going to be the cause of your happiness, whereas in fact he's a rapist.
Yeah,
that's possible, isn't it? You can believe that you really believe cake will make you happy, but all it does is give you indigestion.
Yeah.
Can you accept that? So you do accept that in your mind there are some parts of your mind that cause you to see things in a way they don't exist. You get that?
Yes.
That view, that's Buddha's view. That's his essential view. That there are things in our mind that cause us to see things in the way they don't exist. And he says that disconnect between reality and our view is why we suffer. Can you see, if you think, I'll give you a £5 note and you think it's 50, you're going to get really excited. But you'll get extremely disappointed when you go spend it and they'll give you £5 worth and not 50, wouldn't you? Because you had a misconception. You over-exaggerated the value of the £5 note, yeah? You saw something that wasn't there. So to that extent, you built up an expectation, didn't you? And so to that extent, when you get to see the truth, you'll be disappointed, won't you? Won't you? Buddha says this is why we suffer. Because in our mind, we have the ego grasping, which is the deepest, which believes in a Vanessa in a way that Vanessa doesn't exist, which gives rise to this massive neediness in Vanessa that causes her to hanker after this and hanker after that, which then causes her to, because she feels empty and...
She wants something that's not actually her.
Because, no, more than that. No, that's not the point. No, you just missed. I'll start again. In Vanessa, there's this, in this mental consciousness of Vanessa's, assuming you're a sentient being like the rest of us, you know, you've got in your mental consciousness a bunch of qualities. Some of them are negative, some are positive, okay? And the negative ones the root delusion here is the one that's called ignorance, that truly believes most primordially, most instinctively, and is eons old, Buddha says, that there is an inherent I there. Just say the words, it doesn't matter. There is an inherent I. You don't think you think it. We don't think we think it, but Buddha says you do. On the basis of this, this causes you to be separate from others. It causes you to feel bereft and lonely and needy and yearning, and therefore you crave to have cakes and people and things and praise and nice sounds and nice smells because you feel like you're missing something. This is the suffering of attachment. Then you believe, when you see the chocolate cake because you're so needy for happiness, the cake will look really delicious to you, and then you'll have this expectation that when I get it, it'll make me happy. Or if it's Fred, you'll expect when you get Fred, he'll make you happy. And then you expect Fred to make you happy. And then he just... So always we've got this disconnect between how we see things and how in reality they are. In general, all of them are liars, all delusional, but different levels of delusion. So the general thing is this root delusion, the main one, such that when you've finally seen how it's a lie, that's what liberation is. That's the beginning of your end of all your suffering. Once you've seen... like you see the absence of blue on a red thermos. Once you've seen the absence of that fantasy, Vanessa, that you've been clinging to for eons, this is the beginning of the end of your suffering. From that second on, you can't fall back into suffering lives. You can only now become an enlightened being, which means you can see the minds of all beings, which means you have infinite compassion, infinite wisdom. You're completely blissful. You become a Buddha, basically, because of this. And you're not a Buddha, and you are keep suffering, the extent to which you cling to the self-existent me. So why it sounds so abstract to us is because it is so primordial, because it is so instinctive, and we don't even see it. Basically, it's a lie in your mind about how you and everything else exist, which isn't how they exist. Can you hear the words? And that's what we have to sort of look into. That's all. I mean, Buddha might be talking about a load of rubbish, but that's for us to find out, isn't it? Where's the mic, please? We didn't have it. We've lost the mic. It's gone. Back there, sorry.
Here it is.
Go, darling.
When I listened to you, I was thinking about mass media and the influence on us, and there's theories around and proof that we have been manipulated on a large scale by being told the wrong things and taught the wrong things. Particularly in religion, you're not going to organize religion.
Sure. So then?
But also history lessons, whatever, because human history is written by humans who have particular interests in mind.
Right, that's right, of course it is. That's
and
how it is,
there's a large scale control going on around us.
Well, there's no.
How does
no,
that.
That's conspiracy theories, darling. There's just a bunch of people like you and me who all believe in their own views and then put them out there in books and things. So it's up to each one of us. I mean, some people buy into Hitler, some people don't. Some people buy into Buddha, some people don't. It's up to us to be the boss, isn't it? And to see through other people's viewpoints and get to see what we think is true. So we all have to grow up.
Yeah, but still kind of, at the moment, they say we are at the verge of rising consciousness.
What, darling?
At a verge of an edge of rising consciousness.
When? Where's this rising consciousness? I'd like to meet it. Where?
Well, you see more revolutions worldwide now, people rising up against powers which are abusive,
that's
actually.
That's a rising consciousness, isn't it?
Of course it is. If you are being abused, and you know you're being used all the time.
Well, not according to the Buddha's view.
Sorry?
Not according to the Buddha's view. That just sounds more...
Is it not? Why not?
No, that just sounds like more anger, more blame.
Say again?
It sounds like more anger, more blame, baby. That's not revolution. That's just another variation of the same theme.
If the end result is trying to help others,
if it is that,
clearly identify some wrongdoing in society,
if it is that, that's called compassion, and go for it. That's amazing. Yeah. Well done. Go for it.
But it's compassion,
the Buddha would say
isn't
you
it?
Need to know the causes of it. We're talking the Buddha's view here. You're talking a revolutionary view. Okay, that's cool. You may have that view. But the Buddha's approach to it, like those two young nuns, they know why they got abused. They even, because they were advanced, were able to have compassion. For us, the first step would be to back away. And then if you've got the Buddha's view, which is a big ask, you know. So here we're talking the Buddha's view. In this room, we're talking Buddha's view.
Doesn't mean if you watch something going wrong around you...
That's called compassion.
No, no, but
that
okay.
That is called compassion.
No, no. We are in a cafe. You know, so you see somebody behind me taking my purse out of my handbag.
And that's called
what
compassion.
What do you do as a Buddhist?
That's
saying she has bad karma. I'm not going to interact.
That's called compassion. Compassion is action.
It's compassion action.
Is action. compassion. As Martin Luther King said, it's good to see what's wrong, but then you just don't rant and rave and shout and rise up. You say, what can I do to help? That's called compassion, sweetheart.
Oh, okay. Then we just use different words for the same thing, actually.
Sorry?
We just use different words for the same thing.
Maybe we do. Depends.
I think we do. Yeah.
Good. Okay, darling. Yes.
Hi, I think I'm having an absence of understanding.
Good. okay. Well done.
In terms of the self, is Buddha saying there is something that we call self, but what we currently think of as being an immutable, concrete,
that's
like
it.
Me,
that's
I'm Catherine, I stay the same forever and ever.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a delusion.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
But there is the bit of me which is this mind stream that changes.
No, that's not yourself though. Okay, let's go. Okay, as Lama Zabra Rinpoche says, perfect, thank you, Catherine. As Lama Zabra Rinpoche says, when we finally realized the emptiness of the inherent I, he says, it's as if there's no I, but there is. But what does exist is so subtle, it's as if Catherine is an illusion. This sounds cute, but it's meant to be utterly true. So it's an incredibly tricky thing, because the Buddha talks about, first of all, there are things that do exist conventionally. There is a Catherine. We label Catherine on this person, as opposed to, what's your name again, darling?
Christiane.
Christiane. So we know this person there, female person known as Catherine. He's a female person known as Christiane, and we don't get them confused. If we do, we're in trouble, you know. I love Christiane, but I really mean Catherine. We're going to get very upset. So we have to get our facts right. That's dependent arising. This is a red thermos, you know. So we work out our dependent arisings, things that do exist. We name it, we label it, and then we all agree on the label. So now we're comfortable. But our trouble, so what Buddha says is this. Catherine is completely empty of existing as an inherent Catherine. There is no Catherine at all from the side of Catherine. There is nothing there that causes Catherine to be Catherine. Catherine is completely empty of inherent existence. So as soon as we hear that, we go, uh-oh, there's no Catherine, and we chuck the baby out with the bathwater. Nihilism. We misheard it. We didn't get it. It's so subtle. Then what happens is Buddha, that's ultimate reality, emptiness. As soon as we hear emptiness, we chuck the baby out with the bathwater, and we become nihilistic. Oh, well, there's no Catherine. Kill myself. Wrong view. We just went too far. Now that we hear Buddha says, there is a Catherine that does exist in dependence upon many factors, causes, conditions, parts, and all sorts of things. As soon as we hear there is a Catherine, we go, oh, thank God, there's Catherine after all. Grasp. Well, that's the other extreme view. We just over-exaggerated Catherine. So we either have this view of eternalistic, real, solid, permanent, definite Catherine, or we have the view there's no Catherine, and they're the two extreme views, Buddha says. And the trick is hearing these two truths, the way Buddha talks about it, relative truth, conventional truth, that there is a Catherine that does exist interdependently, and that there is no Catherine from her own side, that these actually refer to the same thing. They actually mean the same thing. So it's almost like smoke and mirrors in the end. It almost seems like when we describe there is no Catherine from the side of Catherine, you can't help but hear there's no Catherine, but it doesn't mean there's no Catherine, because there is a Catherine that does function. And the key is to understand the different levels of dependent arising, because that's the thinking we have to do that leads us to the conclusion of the emptiness of Catherine. So it's extremely tricky, but it's not tricky in a clever way. It's just very refined and precise and needs much analysis and meditation to get it accurate. So slowly we then get to hear, every time we hear dependent arising, we say to ourselves, that means there's no Catherine from her own side. Every time we hear there's no Catherine from her own side, that means there is a Catherine, dependent arising Catherine. So dependent arising and emptiness actually refer to the same thing, although they appear completely opposite. So our job is to get them closer and closer to eventually with the middle way, where actually emptiness and Catherine are simultaneous. And it's just, these are the words for it, you know? This is why it's got to be studied carefully and then meditated on really precisely to see how these two are actually pointing to each other rather than away from each other, which are the instinctive mistakes that our mind makes now, you know. Just a general idea, okay? So let's look at dependent arising a bit more. What time are we supposed to finish today? I was going to do more Tara. I have to do more Tara. I see, okay. I think we have to have afternoon tea. And then we'll do Tara. And then we'll continue this one. That'll do for now. Food for thought for emptiness. So let's have a cup of tea or coffee or whatever you want, and then come back in 25 minutes maybe about that. Then we'll do Tara again. Yeah? Okay? Any dissatisfied customers? Okay. Go. I'll see you soon. Thank you, darlings.